Leading up to the time that I went to Mushe, about a week before, my son, John, it was in preschool, and they were doing sewing, you know, sewing cards and things like that. And I was walking down to, from our bedroom down to the bathroom to have my nightly shower or what have you. And I was walking barefoot. And just as I had my foot going forward without any possibility of stopping it, I noticed that his sewing needle had fallen out of whatever you've been doing and was sticking in the carpet backwards. So it was point down, but it was backwards. And before I could stop myself, I put my big toe right in it and it ran in and snapped off. So all I was left with was the stub of the needle and the cotton still attached to it coming out from inside. So anyway, the doctor, I had to go to hospital and they cut it out. And the other thing that I remember quite vividly was when they were trying to x-ray it. The x-ray technician got the cotton underneath the plate and she was trying to move my foot. And of course the plate was holding the cotton rather firmly. And so I was yelling, "Stop, stop!" And she couldn't work out what I was on about until, you know, I was hurting that much. And I said, "The cotton there, the cotton."
Oh, dear.
Anyway, we got it done. And but the reason why I'm telling you this story is that I was off work for a couple of weeks because I was just hobbling around and couldn't wear a shoe when the news came through. And the PMG engineer, who was my chief, said I had to go in and hand over the job. I was in the throes of more telephone exchange extensions, and I had to go in and get through the necessary formalities of checking off my toolkit and all the other stuff. And I said, "Well, I can hobble in. I have a carpet slipper on one foot." And he said, "Oh, that's okay. Don't worry about that." So I hobbled in and did that. Then I rang Lewis Wainwright, probably before that, but anyway, he said, "When can you start?" And I said, "Oh, I told him about my toe." He said, "Can you sit down? You can sit all right." I said, "Oh, yes, I can do that." He said, and you can walk. I said, "Oh, yeah, I can hobble about." He said, "Well, what about starting tomorrow?" This was Friday. And I said, "Oh, yes, okay, I'd start tomorrow." So that's when I started off. They called for me, and there was about five, including Don Blackman was in the car, and Lewis Wainwright. And I headed off with no idea at all what I was heading for. And we drove out to the turnoff. It was just a country road off, turn off the main road into leading into the where the station was. We drove along this bush track. We came to the gate, and it was opened. We kept on driving, and all of a sudden, I started seeing the towers and the velour dish was up, and I could see this, and it all looked pretty interesting as far as I was concerned, just rising out of the bush. And but the first thing that struck me, they had this, what they call a boresight tower, And it's about 100 or more feet high, and was very accurately located. And the Balort people used to use that as a target. They would transmit a signal from the Borsite Tower, and then they would lock on, and then the data of their, which showed the position of their antenna relative to the position of the Borsite Tower, would show them just how much off they were, how many degrees or so. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, that's a tall tower. Because I had a problem, and it's crazy to be interested in radio transmission when even a thick carpet makes me feel giddy.
It was a very tall tower, wasn't it?
It was a tall tower. Mm. And then I looked at the other ones. There were the acquisition aid, which I found out later had some of our receiving antennas on, my air-to-ground receiving antennas. And I thought, oh, 35 feet, oh, yes, probably I can stagger up that. But it sort of somewhat cooled my fervor for a while. But when we got inside the building, after meeting some of the people, Lewis Wainwright took me down and said, you can start the detailed system test, or DST as we call them, on the receivers. And NASA had two types of tests, a detailed system test, which you did before the mission, and then a brief system test, which you did immediately prior to the mission. So my first thing was to marvel at the these lovely receivers that they had. And but then I started reading the manual through and managed to get through the DSTs okay. And but that was my introduction to Mushay. It all happened on a Saturday. And but Jerry O'Connor, he was a warrant officer in the Air Force, and he was somewhat taken aback when he found that I'd got the top job. And as history recalls, he became more, gained more notoriety from doing what he did,
yeah,
than what I did from just fiddling around with comms.
There's the two acquisition aid antennas near the operations building.
Yes, that's right.
The air ground transmitter at the southern end.
Yeah,
yeah, near the, past the powerhouse.
Yes.
So right. What was the difference between those two towers, the two acquisition aids?
It was mainly diversity. And both receivers, HF receivers, were running diversity, into a diversity combiner. And always you pick the best signal. The frequency was 15016 megahertz. That was a classified frequency. And many of my ham radio friends were ringing me up and saying, give me, what about the frequency, the air-to-ground frequency? I said, you can't have it. Oh, come on. What sort of a mate are you?
Yes.
I said, no, mind you, I can't do it. I'd get killed if I...
Yeah.
And, of course, I knew only too well that somebody would pop in at the time that they were passing and started trying to say, start to talking to the astronauts. And causing all kinds of interference and what have you.
Yes.
Anyway, that was by the way. But we had problems and of noise impacting on the frequency associated with the acquisition aid. And they, of course, immediately came in to me and said, your transmitters are affecting our acquisition aid.
Right.
We're getting some kind of harmonic. And I thought, oh, heck. Well, we had an NF-105, which was a marvellous piece of kit for that day and age, which very heavy. And so the idea was that we would take it up to the top of the antenna itself, and couple it up and then tune through and just find out, well, Jerry was operating the transmitters just to see if we were getting any noise. So there was only one NF-105, very expensive piece of kit, and we thought, how are we going to carry it up? Because the ladder was pretty steep, so we decided we'd put a rope around it and securely tie it and pull this thing up hand over hand so that we got to the top, which we did. But the thing was that we didn't have any guardrails around the antenna, and the space up there was pretty crowded by the time we got three people and this NF-105 and all the rest of the governments that had to go with it. And one head appeared through the hole, and I stood back, and the guy got through, and then I thought I was standing on the balls of my feet, and then I lowered my feet down, and then when I came to where my heel should have touched the surface of the tread plate, I couldn't feel anything.
Oh dear.
And I looked around, and I was right on the edge of it with the balls of my feet, and had I gone back a little bit faster, I might have gone head over heels down onto the hard standing, 35 feet below or whatever. But we found the noise was not us, much to my relief. And talking of the guardrails, it was amazing the wildlife that was around in that area. It's really sandy soil, and the bushes, it's only scrub country, what we'd call, and very few tall trees. And the snakes were pretty prevalent. And before they installed the guardrails, they had them all stacked up on the alongside of the TNC building. And one day, somebody called out, "Snake!" You see, and they all ran, and of course the snake went, and the first thing it did was head straight for the pipe. And it got down there, and there was no way that we could get the snake out. So some enterprising citizen came up with a blowtorch and just heated the pipe fairly gently. And that snake came out at quite a rapid rate. He wasn't very happy either. But the other thing we had were mice, field mice. And when they installed it was all 110 with the commercial type 110 volt outlet. Yeah, we had two outlets. And, of course, no switch. You just plugged it in and away it went. But they only had enough sockets to fill one of the holes. The mice used to come into the building at night, I think primarily because it was a bit warmer. And then they would frighten, and they would head straight for the blank outlet. And, of course, no sooner get in there than get 110 volts. And that was the end of the mouse. And so the one of the engine drivers, God, I forget his name. He was a red-headed guy. One of his first jobs in the morning was to go around with a bucket and pull. You'd see these things with the rear end of the mouse plus the tail sitting out from the hole. He'd just pull it out and drop it into the bucket. But they were just the sort of sidelines. The other thing was that we had Western Electric had the contract for the installation of all the tracking stations. And we had a Western Electric engineer who was oversighting the total installation. A nice bloke. And anyway, I was talking to him and he said, I've got some background material here you might be interested in. I said, oh, yes, please. So the next day came along with this stuff, and the first thing I noticed that every now and again on the top of the page there was a word, H-barrier. And I thought, H-barrier? I knew there was a heat barrier, but I couldn't see any reference to in the page to anything about heat barrier. And I fiddled around there, and a short time later, somebody said, "Have you seen Herman anywhere around?" I said, "Herman who?" He said, "Herman Barrier." It was H. Barrier. But Western Electric did, it was all done by the book. And we had to run the PABX, a series of wet cell batteries, to provide the 50 volts to get it to run. And every morning we had to go and measure the specific gravity of the pilot cell. And the only way we could measure it, it was with a long tube attached to the hygrometer. And invariably, when you took it out, there was always some acid left in the tube. And it would drip down your clothes. And, of course, that wasn't very good for your trousers. And I looked at the... And there was space above the pilot cell, which would be good enough to cut... It would have been relatively easy to cut a hole big enough to put the hygrometer straight down into the cell. So I said to Herman, "Why don't we cut a hole in that, Herman?" "Why?" I said, "Because, you know." He said, "Well, you've got acid-proof overalls." I said, "Yes, but to get into acid-proof overalls and fiddle around, and then it takes you a couple of minutes to... take the reading, and then you've got to take your overalls off, get to the car, da da." And he said, "If Western Electric thought it was necessary to put that hole there, they would have put it there in the first place." End of story.
Yes.
And then we had it was quite an embarrassing moment. The big chief from WECO came out. His name was Goetius. Goetchius. And he was the big boss. And I was showing him around my area of responsibility, the receivers, and we came to the patch panel on the intercom. And that patch panel was a designer's nightmare. And he said, "Oh, and how do you work this?" I'd only been there about 2 weeks, and I hadn't had time to sort of look at the intricacies of it. I had another bloke worrying about the intercom. Well, we looked at it. I said, "Oh, we do this and that," and it didn't work. And I thought, "Oh, God." So Herman came in. He said, "Oh, yes, this is the way you do it." That didn't work either. And so Mr. Goetchius said, "Oh, perhaps we do it this way." Click, click, that didn't work either. So we all turned around and laughed at one another and said, "Well, it looks like we need to know a bit more about the patch panel." But it was a real nightmare. But once you got to know it, it was relatively, well, straightforward. And we had a PMG teletype technician, because all Model 28 teletype equipment, ASRs and ROs, and I forget what the tape recorders, where it just produced paper tape. It didn't print anything or did anything, but it was like a monitor which you had patched into the appropriate circuit. And so the PMG lent us the guy whose name was Peter Saw. And he was a good bloke, you know. He really knew his Model 28 equipment. And it was relatively reliable. It was, of course, it was one of the mainstays of those days of teletype equipment. But we used to have a radio circuit to the Indian Ocean ship, a voice and teletype circuit. And that was, the information came to us from the States And then we then turned it back to OTC, transmitter station, which in turn would then transmit it to the IOS. The IOS in response would then go back to the receiving station at, in the middle of Perth. And then, of course, when the received signal was received at the receiving site at ODC, they would then poke it back to us, and we would then on forward it to the States. And again, that was all part of my responsibilities, was to make sure that link always worked.
Was that Applecross?
Applecross, that's it. Yeah. Was that Wireless Hill?
Yep.
I never got to see that. I went out to the transmitting station. That was in, something was a forest. It was halfway sort of between, from memory, about halfway between Perth and Mushay. And, we had a pretty good relationship with the station manager out there, whose name again I can't remember, but to jump forward a little bit in time, when we were preparing for the Wally Schirra 14 orbit mission, the orbits were getting progressively higher up towards Japan, and it was getting outside of our ability to receive it and or track it. And the IOS was relocated up in the Japanese area. So they were tracking the, or were supposed to be tracking the spacecraft and transmitting the data via HF back through us, back to Goddard. And
it's a long way around, isn't it?
Oh, yes. So NASA bought some, sent over some log periodic antennas, one for the receiving site and one for the pine plantation or something like that. And this was the marvel of the model age. It was fully log periodic, which enabled it to, you know, cover the whole spectrum. And it was supported by two vertical towers, and the antenna itself was supported by those two towers and was able to turn to see in any direction. And the station manager was so thrilled with this thing. Oh, this is the best thing since sliced bread, you see. And every day he'd sort of ring me and say, oh, we're getting to this stage, we'll be able to start testing shortly, because we were heading towards a mission or a simulation or something. Then, all of a sudden, I hadn't heard from him for a week. And I thought, oh, that's strange. So I rang him, and I said, oh, how's the log periodic going? Dead silence. He said, we dropped it. I said, you what? He said, we dropped it. I said, oh, my God, you know what? How? Oh, he said, well, we had to attach a steel cable to the antenna, and we just, you know, lifted it up. And once you got to the just below the 45-degree angle of the one of greater strength, he said, I was watching it, and the cable that we were using wasn't long enough, so we jointed some more on. And I saw the joint unravel, and it unraveled, and the next moment, crash. I said, well, what are we going to do? He said, problem is it's 30-degree angle aluminium, and we can't locate any of it in Australia. And by the time we get some stuff shipped out from the States or the manufacturer, he said, it's going to take weeks. I said, well, you know, though, I've got to tell NASA about this. And he said, oh, yes, he said, I do know. I said, well, what can we do? He said, ah, we've been doing some tests and we've got a rhombic antenna pointed at London. He said, if we take off the termination, he said, we'd get a very big side lobe which reaches out and would cover the Japanese area. I said, oh, okay. He said, it won't be as good. Well, I'm sorry, but I did have two antennas. I said, well, the other antenna's working okay. He said, yes, that's working okay. But he said, the only thing I can suggest we do is that we were particularly going into the day-night or night-day transition,
yeah,
where the frequencies suddenly change because the ionosphere change goes up and down very erratically. He said, the only thing we can do about it is for you to tell us which is the best signal. And he said, we'll have the signal that will be up on two frequencies,
mm,
and you can listen to it, and anything time you see it starting to fade, tell us which is the best one. And he said, and we'll get the guy, and the tech on duty will rush out, and he'll have to swap from the rhombic over to the...
to the log periodic.
Yeah, the other antenna. And I said, oh, well, if that's the only way we can do it, so I relayed all this information back to Goddard, and they said, oh, okay, well, if that's the way it's got to go, that's the way it's got to go. Well, we went into that mission. Oh, that guy, I nearly ran him into the ground because 15 minutes would make the difference between getting a good signal on frequency one or not on frequency two, and then the guy would have to go and change the... And they never complained, you know. I'd say, we're better on number one or whatever we call it. We had to call it something or other.
Mm.
And they would drop the rhombic off and bring that frequency up on the... Oh, gosh, it kept me on my toes too because the signal wasn't the best even then. To me, every day was interesting and exciting, and particularly as we came nearer to launch, and we had, as I said, they brought out the flight control team, always with the astronaut in charge as the CAPCOM, and I forget which mission it was, but the range safety officer, I think it was before Ham, the chimpanzee flight, but the range safety officer had to destroy it because it started going off course or something. And some of the Americans were crying because, you know, the pressure was so much on everybody to try and beat the rush.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, I always felt that this was a real cold war which could only benefit people rather than a hot war which should just finish up killing a lot of people. And it's like, it was my old man can beat your old man, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yes, but at least it was achieving something, wasn't it?
Yes. And when you think of the side benefits that came from all that, I think one of the most... It was almost frightening episodes was when they exploded an atomic bomb out in somewhere near Hawaii, and they contacted me and said that they were going to set off this bomb, and they wanted me to monitor and record the communications. And so they set up the teletype circuit that we had, and when that thing went off, it was just like as though a gigantic mixing machine had got to work. And one moment we had teletype. Next minute we just had noise, and was really weird sounds, you know? And it lasted for a long time.
Oh.
And I thought, my God, what's going to happen if this thing doesn't settle down? And it took quite a while. I can't think whether it was hours or days. It was, certainly wasn't days, but it was a long time that we had this thing going. But I'll never forget the sounds. It was just like waves. It would, one moment the signal would be quite strong, and the next moment it would be so totally garbled. Very interesting. We had, of course, from all the way from Mushay, the landlines went to Perth, and then from Perth it got on the main trunk route over to Adelaide, and then from there to Sydney. And it was all open wire line with carrier systems on, you know, running over the top of it. But it was pretty vulnerable, as you can well imagine, that length of line. And we had, when I was a PMG, one of the most common cause of outage were caused by flocks of galahs. The galahs would suddenly all take flight and fly up and fly into the telephone lines, and they would then get twisted up and strangled by the line, but you then had to find it. But and that was, of course, that was more of a day, evening, early morning type of chance that you'd lose the line. But we had one particular corner on the way to from Perth, and then it went up to my old stamping ground in Meriden, and you'd be astounded at the number of times we lost that pole by people just driving straight into it. It was, why they didn't put a protective fence around it or not, I don't know. But, and in this particular case, we had again, I can't remember whether it was a mission or a simulation. I hope it was a simulation, because everything went dead. Well, you know, and I got in touch with the test desk at in Perth, and they said, oh, it's that pole, we think it's around about this corner, and they named the corner. They said, we've got a team of lineys out going out to fix it, and they reported back in due course. They said, well, somebody has hit the pole and sheared the pole off at the base. The only thing that's supporting the pole is the wire. And we've unscrambled the lines as well as we can, and we've put pikes in. I don't know whether you're familiar with the word pike, but it's just a long pole with a spike at the end, and they dig it into the ground and dig it into the pole. And that tends to hold it up. They said, we've piked it well, and we think it's going to be all right, but... I said, what's the possibility of it going over? Oh, well, you know, we can't tell that. I said, well, I'm not very happy with this. You better get the team to stay there all night. And it was one of these bloody cold nights. I've always felt sorry for these blokes, but anyway. They said, oh, yes, okay. So they would have got a bit of overtime.
Anyway. Yes.
The thing that was my constant concern was all the way through, right through to the flight of shuttle, was what if? Because it wasn't going to be the big things that hit you. It was the little things. Like, what happens if the power goes and we haven't checked the batteries and the emergency light? Because if you're pitch dark, there's no windows, you can't get any light from outside. Anyway, we'll get to that when we get to things, because a few interesting things happened because of that. That was right up until the end, and I thought, when I was getting ready for the shuttle, I thought, oh, look, Kev, you've been doing it since 1960, and really nothing, well, things had gone wrong, but you've got through it all right. Mm. Don't worry, don't worry. And I know that's the time you worry.
Yes.
When you become complacent that nothing's going to turn. Mm.
At Musha, you wouldn't have had any backup circuits, I guess, would you?
Well, we did have one via the post office at Musha, but it was a sort of on loan type of thing. The backup circuits that we had going overseas was a mixture of the cable from Hawaii. Anyway, it was that. So there was radio from OTC to Hono, and from Hono to States. But then we had the undersea cable, and 35 words a minute, and subject to magnetic storms. And so it was a little bit guess and be God.
So your normal communications path from Musha was open wire, through Musha?
Yeah,
and then down
through Musha, but we had a direct line, which a direct circuit from the tracking station into Perth. But then we had another one to Musha, the town or what, village or whatever you call it, back to Perth, like their own post office communication, and we could use that if we had a problem.
So in terms of voice circuits, if you listen to the recordings of John Glenn's pass over Musha, of course they could hear that at Cape Canaveral, couldn't they?
Yes, it was all real time. It was something that always used to... again, this is another story for Carnarvon, but Canberra. But the station directors, and we're always saying, Honeysuckle does this, and we'll do this, and we'll do that. And I often thought quietly to myself, it doesn't really matter how good the antenna works. If our communication don't work, you better hope that your recorders are working. But Lewis Wainwright summed it up. This was a general attitude. Again, this is Carnarvon, but I said to him one day, how are we doing, Lewis? And he says, all right. we'd done something with communications at that stage. And I expected him to say, you did a good job on that. And he said, Kev, communications are like electricity and water into my house. He said, when I turn on the water tap, I expect water. When I flick the electric light switch, I expect electricity. He said, when I pick up the phone, I expect my phone to be working. And he wasn't interested in how it did it, just that it did it.
Yes. Just coming back to Musha and to the TNC building, your comms room was in the next room over from the acquisition and control room, wasn't it?
It started off at the... I don't know whether I was north or south or east or west, but the first building that you... first room was the communications room, and the next room had the telemetry and time standard and radio receivers. And the next room... That room that I was saying had the telemetry in, the one half of that room had the Capcom consoles and all that area. And then on the other half, we had the receivers and the time standard. It was the next room that had the telemetry equipment. Yes. When we first started off getting ready, practicing for the simulations, they actually sent a person out with scripts. It was M&O, this GCC, And the M&O would then respond, go ahead. And then you'd come up with whatever you had to tell him. And it was... Fortunately, I'd done a bit of repertory work in my youth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was used to working from scripts. But some of the other guys, they thought this was a lot of... Well, I won't use the word, but you know what I'm talking about. It's just sitting around here. All we're doing is just talking. And with M and O, that is and Roger and Wilco and all these things. And says, yeah, she'll be right, mate. And the guy tried to explain to people, and which I was fully understood, that you had to learn this stuff so that you automatically responded in that way, because if you had a problem and started talking over the loop, you could just cause more confusion because the person wouldn't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And this Roger and there's one particular saying which sounded ridiculous when we first started using it, but then at the end, you realize that there was no misunderstanding that comment. But we used to practice that and practice it and practice it until you became so familiar with it. And I think it was Wally Schirra's mission. You've probably seen that photo of me in my pajamas on the Daily News, front page of Daily News.
No, I don't think I've seen that one.
Haven't you?
No.
I have a copy, but it's not available at the moment. Because of these long, 14-orbit missions, and the fact that the communication was via Mushe, they hired a caravan and for myself, and then there was the engineer in charge of communications, he was the site engineer, in other words, he was just, and so we slept there, and this photo was taken early in the morning because the reporters had come and wanted to take a photo of us, you see, so
yeah.
I was in pyjamas and the other, Gus Pugh was in his dressing gown, I think, and Jerry O'Connor was there, so the three of us were chatting and taking, and that appeared on the Daily News that night, and of course the rubbishing I got from a friend, we know you sleep on your job, but gee, you're actually wearing your pyjamas, but as I pointed out afterwards, from there on, I worked 36 hours straight, and I was that tired at the end that they wouldn't let me drive home. They would have organized a car for me. But we had a few of those sorts of episodes, and my job when they had, when the Vilort achieved track, there would be a call which they would go over the loop, like Lord on track or whatever, you see, and then the next moment they'd be saying data to line, and then my thing was to push the data RDCU, radar data control unit, which then put the teletype data, which it was, from the Lord straight to line. And this particular evening night, I'd had a few problems with communication. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think. And I looked around, and everything was quiet. I thought, my God, we should have had a pass. I've been asleep. What's going on? I hadn't been asleep, but, And I raced over, and the radar control unit was working. Everything else was working perfectly. I'd done it automatically. And that's what this, the purpose of this, little script readings is all about.
All the simulations.
To the point where you did everything automatically, and then you had your mind clear to do the non-automatic problems.
Probably should ask you if you'd like to maybe talk through what happened on a manned pass. What was the sequence of events in acquiring a spacecraft?
First thing, of course, we got these AOS messages, which the first one came, I think it was approximately 30 minutes before actual acquisition. And then we then got a further update about 5 or 10 minutes before the actual acquisition, because it was being continuously refined. And so once we got that, that was immediately relayed to the acquisition, I and the Valort people. And then we just waited around with bated breath, because if anything was going to go wrong, it was probably going to start then, you see. And a little hatchway, which led, opened up and went from the comms room into the, where the capsule communicator and all the control people were. And then the job, once the tracking was in progress and providing there were no other problems, you just sat there and waited with your fingers crossed, waiting for the aeromed people and the telemetry people and the astronaut in charge, everybody getting their heads together and, you know, pointing out the data and seeing what the trends were and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to get this tracking data message, or this message, there was a special name for it, out, and it was quite a lot of typing required, and we were supposed to get it online ASAP, you see. And I remember it was Gordon Cooper, and they were got into long-winded discussing, and I finally couldn't stand any longer. I opened the hatch and I said, "Come on, you guys, we're running. I've got to get this bloody message out." It didn't make much difference to them, so. But the other thing was up my tail was the fact that if Woomera got their message online before I did, that was bad news. But as I said before, they got the AOS message, and then everybody would tense up. And
that'd come from Goddard, I suppose, would it?
Yeah, from Goddard. And the first thing you get over the loop was that the AOS people, the acquisition aid people, would lock on, and the Valort was immediately slave to the ACK aid, and then, but they would also be looking to make sure that the angles that they were pointing at were the same angles that they were supposed to be pointing at,
mm-hmm.
and not looking at a side lobe. And once we got that magical sound, Valort has tracked, and then there would be the Jerry would then come up and start calling the spacecraft, and as soon as they acknowledged the signal and the strength of the signal, he would hand over to the Capcom, and of course everybody would be reporting the status of their equipment, like the time standard people. I had one guy I had on the time standard.
Cole McNish.
Cole McNish, that's it.
Mm.
And Cole was busy making sure that the time that was being printed out on the recorders was the actual time that it was supposed to. And everybody was, you know, just making sure that everything was working normally, properly. And then I'd get the call that Valort had track, and then they were over the loop. They'd just be telling me that the data was coming. I'd just call our data online, and then we then just sit and fingers crossed until the track was finished,
because
it was only about 8 minutes.
Yes, pretty quick, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was quick.
And then Woomera would take over.
Yeah, Woomera would take over then.
When you were all reporting your status on the loop, that was to the M&O, was it?
To the M&O, yeah.
So that was that Gus?
Yeah. Sometimes it was Gus, sometimes it was Lewis. But Lewis was the M&O, and, you know, he carried the end responsibility. At Gus Pugh would do it, and Lewis was always standing close by.
Yeah. So Lewis was the station director initially, wasn't he? Was it Frank Dawson?
No, he wasn't.
Frank Dawson was.
Yes. He was a bureaucrat.
So Frank wasn't an operations guy, really?
Oh, no.
Was Lewis was.
I had serious words with Frank Dawson. The reason why that came up was that the communications could not leave the station until we got the all clear from Goddard. And if the line went down, you just had to wait till the line came back up again. And sometimes it would take more, 1 or 2 hours. And in the initial instance, where we were going by bus, there were a lot of restive people.
Yes.
Saying, why aren't we going? Come on, get that thing going. Which we had no control over at all. So they finally gave me a comm car. And with that comm car, I could then drive. And I had to take the teletype operator to a certain point and drop her off. This was Frank Dawson's edict. Drop her off, and then I could then continue home, you see. And this particular night, it was about closer to 3 o'clock in the morning. And I came to this point, and it was all dark, and the buses, of course, had stopped running. And I said, oh, come on, Glennis, I'll take you home. So I drove her home. And the next morning, Frank Dawson called me into his desk and said, what's all this about you taking the teletype operator home? I said, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, I wasn't going to let a young girl get out of the car and then find her own way home from there. Well, you were instructed to do that. I said, look, I don't care what my instructions are. I said, I'm fearful for the girl's safety. And I said, how would you like it if your daughter was just left there? Well, we locked horns for quite a while. And he said, well, I don't want you to see it. You do that again. And I said, if the circumstances arise, I will. And I turned on my heel and left. I wasn't very popular with Frank from then on. Rules are for when brains run out, you know. And if you see things that aren't right, you try to do your best to make them right.
So what was Lewis's position initially then? Senior engineer or something? Or?
Yeah, I think he was senior engineer. Mm. He was the engineer in charge of all other engineers. You know? But then they put Frank Dawson in as the administrator, you see, because nobody had any understanding or idea of what the operational requirements were.